They know the information that they want to teach. They know it well enough that they know which content of their subject is most important. And let's also assume that this individual has worked through how to teach their subject from a Christian perspective. Regardless of whether or not their own training was from a secular school or a Christian school when they were a high school student or a college student, they've made some real progress in sorting out the non-Christian ideas from the Christian principles that they want to teach to their students. They've thought about how we study history from a Christian perspective. This person has an understanding of Christian education, but they're just beginning down the road of understanding classical education. And this is where I see some similarities, some patterns of experience in teachers that I have worked with and teachers that I have talked to, and in things that I have worked through myself as a history teacher. This individual probably has read about the philosophy of classical education. Maybe they read Dorothy Sayre's article, The Lost Tools of Learning, or they've read Doug Wilson's book, either the first or the second, on recovering the lost tools of learning, or they've been to an ACCS conference, or they've been to a summer teacher training workshop. They become acquainted with the preeminent goal of classical education. And I say that knowing that classical sometimes is defined in different ways, so maybe I shouldn't assume that. But for the case of my talk this morning, the preeminent goal of classical education is teaching students how to learn for themselves by providing them with the tools of learning. The preeminent goal is teaching students how to learn for themselves by providing them with the tools of learning. And these individuals, in their reading and in their listening, they've learned some new vocabulary words. The poll parrot stage and the pert stage and the poetic stage. They've heard about grammar and logic, dialectic, as the two sometimes are mixed interchangeably, and rhetoric. These words all have something to do with the trivium, the threefold way. Remember, the trivium was always in preparation for what came later. It wasn't focused on as an end in itself, but it was always forward thinking. These students who've completed the trivium are going to be prepared for the quadrivium, which follows after it. So the trivium always had that idea of preparation in it. These individuals are familiar with Dorothy Sayre's convention of matching stages of childhood to the stages of the trivium. She observed children, and she noticed that they had certain common characteristics at different stages of their development, and she said this matches up nicely with the three stages of the trivium, these three stages of childhood. And these same teachers understand why certain subjects are taught in classical schools. They've read enough or they've heard enough that they understand why. Not just that classical schools all seem to teach Latin, but there's a reason that they all seem to teach Latin, and why classical schools are teaching logic, and why they're teaching rhetoric, things that aren't seen typically in other schools. All of those things demonstrate a beginning understanding of the philosophy of classical education. But what it seems to be the case is that it's much easier to understand the goals of classical education than it is to know how to teach differently in our classrooms. It's one thing to understand the philosophy, but what teachers want to know, what I want to know as a teacher, is how do I make this happen on a daily basis in my classroom? Philosophy sounds good. What do I need to do? And that leads to the topic at hand today: how is history taught differently in a classical school? Now, I think that the actual solutions to this matter would vary a bit, should vary a bit, depending on the age of the student involved. There are different things that we would do for younger students, elementary students, junior high students, high school students, and it would depend somewhat on the subject matter. The things that a history teacher would do might vary a little bit from what a science teacher would do or what an English teacher would do. As I mentioned, my experience is in history. I've taught some Bible, and I've taught some PE, and I've even taught some math and rhetoric, but mostly I've taught history. So the examples that I'll be using today mainly come from what I know best, the course that I teach on the Civil War. But I think, I think we need more workshops like this in other future ACCS conferences covering every content area. And I hope today to start us thinking about these differences and how we teach classically, and that others might build on that in the future, not just in history, but in other subject areas in the curriculum. This is the question that all teachers seem to ask at one time or another. My staff members at Logos have asked me about this. People that have attended our summer teacher training have asked me about this. And it shows me that the teachers that I've talked to, they understand the philosophy of classical education. They understand that it's a good thing. They have a sincere desire to implement it in their classrooms. They just want to be assured that they are doing it, or they want to know how they're doing it. They want to know the things that they're thinking of, well, isn't this what I should be doing, that that's the right thing. And I want to begin by discussing what Jim Nance, our logic teacher, has defined as core arguments. Every subject in the curriculum has its own core arguments. And what are core arguments? Core arguments are the essential truths that are inherent in that subject. Core arguments are the essential truths that are inherent in that subject. They not only, as Jim has defined it, they not only include the truths, but the proofs of those claims. Both things. The what and the how we know those things to be true. They are the elements that are essential if one is going to say that he has taught that subject. So you might think of whatever history class or class that you're teaching and take one to conduct a little mind experiment with, and pick one of the history courses that you teach. And just think for a minute and say, could I come up, and there are probably more, but I'm sure there are, but say, could I come up with five things that at the end of my time of teaching, a semester or a year, these are things that if I'm going to say I've taught this subject, my students should be familiar with, my students should know. Okay, those are core arguments. The claim and the proof together form the core arguments. You could define this negatively and say that if we haven't taught the core arguments, that we haven't taught our subject, in fact. You could put it that strongly. In algebra, for example, we might say that a core argument is the need to solve for a variable. Okay? Students have to understand that. Core arguments, particularly for junior high school students, are those arguments that provoke junior high school students to say, why? Or how do we know that is true? Elementary age students tend to accept what their teacher says as gospel truth. And if you're a parent of an elementary student and you ever try to teach something differently than the way the elementary teacher has taught, you know this to be true. Dad, that's not the way my teacher said it. Not the way my teacher taught me. And it's wonderful about these young children that they're so trusting. And they have such great respect for their elementary teachers. But when the students move into junior high, as Dorothy Sayers has told us, and you know if you've worked with junior high school students, that's no longer enough. And it's a good thing that they want to know then, why is that true? How do we know that is true? And we want to encourage them to think this way. We want them to ask these questions. Now, core arguments can be shown to be true or proved to be true two different ways. They can be taught or proved inductively or deductively. Deductive arguments are judged to be either sound or unsound, and they are derived from universal statements. If the arguments are valid, and if the premises are true, we say that the arguments are sound. Geometry is mostly deductive. Math teachers start with an established set of assumptions or definitions, and then they build or expand on these assumptions by applying deductive logic. I was told that Euclid started with a few definitions and 10 axioms when he wrote some of his work on geometry, and they build from those definitions and those principles. Inductive arguments are either strong or weak, and the stronger the argument, the more probable the outcome, and a larger sample size improves the reliability of the result. So one of the things we talked about this year with the secondary staff is applying the philosophy of classical education to say, And this would be true for junior high and high school students more than elementary, that all students should both identify and be taught to analyze the core arguments and claims in each subject that they are studying. So one of the things we'd want to do to teach classically is think about what are those core arguments, be sure we identify them to the students as core arguments, and then teach them how we know those things to be true. There are several things that we would need to do to ensure that we are giving students practice with the core arguments in our class. First, and I've already mentioned this, we need to identify all the core arguments of our subject. So we need to sit down and make a list and go through our curriculum guides and think about the material that we're covering and try to prioritize it. What must I include to say that I've taught that subject? What, if I omit, have I not done justice to this course? And this would, and I have not done this yet. This is something we talked about this spring in our staff training. But then we'd need to write out the arguments for those core arguments. And that would be good practice for me, and I trust for you, because it would force us to look at the assumptions that we maybe have adopted about those things. And it's not that we've adopted false assumptions, it just would be good practice for us to go through and ask ourselves, I'm teaching these things, have I assumed them to be true, and how do I know they're true? Or am I just passing on what I've received without really thinking through it? And we need to figure out how those arguments are proved, what's the best way to prove them, and then lead our students through an analysis of those arguments. A related activity to this would be to think about the major errors that have been made in our content area in the past and identify those to our students as well. Again, particularly if you're working high school students, some of whom will attend Christian colleges and universities and some of whom won't, it would be a good thing to present them with ideas that they are going to hear when they leave your Christian school and to be able to prepare them to address some of those arguments as well so they don't hear those for the first time outside of your school, but they get some practice and some recognition of those ideas while they're still at your school. One of the core arguments in my class, for example, is that there are states' rights that limit the power of the federal government. And these rights include nullification and secession. A core idea in my class, in the first quarter we talk about the causes of the war, is some states claim that they had the right to nullify a law passed by Congress if the law was unconstitutional. A related state right would be states could secede from the Union. How would I go about proving that core argument? We would have to look at the historical basis for that argument. We would have to go and look back at history and see how that developed. We would probably start with the Articles of Confederation. Even though the articles weren't enforced when some of the states actually used nullification and secession, it'd be good to start. That was the first time we tried to put a national government together. What kind of powers was it given? Does it say anything about nullification? Does it say anything about secession or states' rights? We'd then look at the Constitution of the United States. Was anything changed from the Articles to the Constitution? We'd also look at historical examples. When did states actually not just talk about nullification or secession, but were there any times, and what were the times when they actually used them? And in my case, these would include the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions over the Alien and Sedition Act, when Jefferson and Madison wrote about and said states have this power to nullify, even though they didn't nullify anything, but they claimed that states did. Or the Hartford Convention during the War of 1812, when the New England states sort of hinted that if things didn't change, they might secede. And the nullification crisis of 1830, which is over some tariff issues, some protective tariff issues. And Calhoun in South Carolina and the state of South Carolina objected to that. And they actually voted to nullify a tariff law that Congress had passed. Those would be historical examples that we would look at. And then we'd also look at the writings of those who argued for the existence of such state powers and those who argued against the use of such state powers. That topic, states' rights, is a core argument, one that we must analyze in our discussion of the causes of the war. Another core argument that would need similar study would be the slavery issue, particularly its biblical morality. We would, in our case, we would go through what the scriptures have to say about the topic of slavery. What does the scripture have to say about the slave trade? What does the scripture have to say about owning a slave? What does the scripture have to say about treating a slave? And start there with the kids. And then we'd want to look at slave narratives. What did the people who were slaves have to say about their experience? What about quotations or observations from people who were alive at the time slavery existed, people that we respect, like Washington or Lee? What did they say about the institution? And then look at some of the debates between those in favor of slavery and those opposed to slavery, try and understand some of the arguments there. Those are core arguments. And we also have something called then secondary arguments. And as Jim has defined them, as we have discussed them, secondary arguments are arguments that are interesting and relevant to our discussion, but they aren't essential. That's the difference. Core arguments can't be left out. Secondary arguments could. Okay. Things like the Battle of Vicksburg was the turning point of the war, or General Longstreet was correct to disagree with General Lee's plan at the Battle of Gettysburg. Those are things that are relevant to the topic and could be taught, but you might say that they could be left out, and you still could say that you've taught a course on the Civil War. The justification is these are topics that are less important. Their inclusion sometimes has to do with an individual teacher's knowledge of the subject matter and some own personal preferences. One of the things you see when you try to write curriculum guides is it's good to leave a certain amount of leeway, not define every course objective and plan every day in the school calendar year. Sometimes teachers have a passion for a particular era or a particular subject, and it's good to leave them some room to teach on those things. Designating core arguments and secondary arguments is a way of prioritizing the content of our subject. That's what it's really about. It's going through and saying, what are the essential things, and what are other good things to teach, given time, after teaching the core arguments. As students, most all of us have grown up accustomed to learning history the new-fashioned way. Okay, most of us did not ourselves have a classical education. Some had a Christian education, but I'm guessing few had classical. One of the difficulties that we face and one of the challenges that we face is teaching our students differently from the way that we were taught. So how do we typically go about the matter of selecting what content to teach in your courses? Well, if we were talking about a brand new teacher, someone who had majored in history in college, we might consider the process that they would go through. And one of the things we know about this individual probably is as they began their first year of teaching, one of the things that immediately hit them was that they knew a lot less about history than they thought they did after finishing their college bachelor's program. Things are familiar, but you have to know it in a different way to stand up in front of a class and teach it than you do to study it as a college student. So it's common then to see first-year teachers grab the textbook, the teacher's edition, maybe some lesson plans from the previous teacher, and maybe, hopefully, some curriculum objectives from the school. If this is the first time teaching through the subject, the teacher then begins their study of the material, their examination material, with two questions in their mind. First, they're thinking about what is the best way to teach this next lesson. The method that they choose doesn't have any particular purpose other than perhaps, say, maintaining students' interest in the lesson. So they're thinking about a method because they want the kids to be interested in the lesson, they want them to like history, they want them to enjoy the subject, and they want to pick something that's effective. If I have the students do this, this will be a good way for them to learn this content. So should I have them read it? Should we discuss it? Should I plan some group activity over it? There are a number of options, but that's one of the questions that's going through this new teacher's mind. In addition to figuring out the best way to teach it, they're also thinking about, okay, I have this textbook. Now, which of this information that's presented in the text is most important? I read through this next chapter and I have to ask myself, do I cover it all equally? Or do I figure out, boy, what's essential? Because I only have 180 days in my school year. That question will take this new teacher a longer time to answer. That may take them going through the course for 2 or 3 years. Depending on how familiar they are with the subject and how well they know it when they begin to teach. If the teacher continues to read broadly, and if they talk with others about their subject, they'll find the answers to their questions a lot quicker. These things, selecting the important information and determining the best way to teach it, that's what a new teacher thinks about, and that's what occupies their time. Now imagine that I'm an elementary teacher and I'm teaching in a classical school. They have to address the same two issues. They have to address questions of teaching method and questions of content. And the answers to those two teaching questions are really related to one another. They're not two separate categories. They're things that are related. Okay, that's because of the classical philosophy of education. So let's take students in the grammar stage. One of the things that elementary teachers in a classical school need to have is a long-range view. In the same way that the trivium is preparation for the quadrivium, and all teachers who teach in the trivium need to have a long-range view. How is this going to help prepare my students for the quadrivium? Teachers in the elementary grades, in the grammar stage, have to have a long-range view and ask themselves, how is this going to help prepare my students for what comes in the dialectic stage and in the rhetoric stage? And that's hard to do, especially for someone who's new to teaching, because they've got their hands full thinking about what's right in front of them and getting through this year to that Christmas vacation and then to that spring break and then to the end of the year. But these elementary teachers not only have to ask themselves which of this historical information is most important, but they have to ask themselves a second question, and that is, which of this information will students need in later stages of the trivium? The pert and the poetic stages. In my history class, I presume that the students already have some knowledge about specific topics in U.S. history. We teach U.S. history at Logos, I believe, in the fourth grade and also in the seventh grade. One of the topics that I want to talk to my sophomores about is the Constitutional Convention, and specifically what decisions were made regarding slavery at the Constitutional Convention, and there were three compromises. One was the 3/5 compromise, how slaves will be counted for determining the representation in the House. And the question of the importation of slaves, was that going to be allowed to continue? And the legal status of a runaway slave, whether or not he was free or still a slave. It really helps me in my discussion with 10th grade students if the students come into the class already knowing some basic information about the Constitutional Convention. If I have to start at what happened in Philadelphia in that long, hot summer, and we have to begin by why were they meeting in the first place, it's going to take me a lot longer in my class than if I can presume upon some familiarity with that knowledge already, and what I'm actually doing is reviewing that information rather than teaching it for the first time. Some of the questions that I would hope that they would be able to answer: what is the Constitution of the United States? Why was it written? Where was the Constitutional Convention held? Who was president of the Constitutional Convention? How does the preamble to the Constitution begin? What was necessary for the Constitution to take effect? What are the first 10 amendments to the Constitution called? What is a Federalist? What is an Anti-Federalist? How strong was the central government under the Constitution? When was the Constitution written? Who is called the father of the Constitution? And if you think about that list, as someone who teaches 10th grade students, I have to be aware of what can a fourth grade student grasp about the Constitutional Convention. When you talk about ideas of government, you're talking about abstract ideas. And some of the particulars, some of the theory is going to be way beyond a fourth grader, but those are grammar level questions that the kids could come into the 10th grade having been familiar with. So if what would be best is if the elementary teachers in fourth and seventh grade have taught that grammar to the students already. And that's an example then of when they come into my class in 10th grade of how it would be a benefit to them if they knew that grammar, and then we can build on the understanding that they already have. I should be able to assume that the students have committed this information to memory. And in his work, The Seven Laws of Teaching, John Milton Gregory wrote quite a bit of what kind of work is necessary if students are going to commit information to memory. And he used an analogy. He said, imagine yourself talking to an artisan, or imagine yourself talking to a professional who deals with lots of details but knows their subject really well. and imagine yourself having a conversation with them, and questions that you ask required very detailed knowledge, they're able to answer quickly because they use the information all the time. Where someone who doesn't use that information all the time would have to stop and think, well, I knew this once and I know where to go look for it and I can find it. But an artisan or a professional, because they use it all the time, it's at their fingertips. Well, how can we ensure that children commit information to memory? By review and by repetition. By review and repetition. We thought about what's important in each subject area, and we thought about what's worth memorizing. I'm interested in what our students learn in history, but in an elementary situation, the teacher also has to think about what do they need to know in English, what do they need to know in math, like multiplication tables, what about Bible, and what about Latin, and also science. So we identify the key information, and then we teach it to our students. But now that we've taught it to our students, they have to commit it to memory. And this requires periodic review. Gregory talks about reviewing on a daily basis and every 3 days and some full-blown reviews over the course of the year. But it also requires review during the following year. Let's say that the fourth grade students studied U.S. history and the fourth grade teacher did a great job of teaching and reviewing some of the grammar of U.S. history. What happens if the fifth grade teacher doesn't review that same information? And let's say that the fifth grade teacher has a completely different subject area. That person's not teaching U.S. history. But if the students are going to remember the information, he or she needs to review the content with his students. Likewise, the sixth grade teacher needs to review this information during the sixth grade year. This is going to take some planning and some coordination between classroom teachers. And I think what it would look like, and I think Matt Whitling is working on this with the Logos Elementary staff, is trying to make some kind of a chart, some kind of a list that identifies in each content area what students are going to be asked to memorize and held accountable to, so the fifth grade teacher can know what the fourth grade teacher has done, and that all that information can be passed along. And it means that some of the fifth grade teacher is going to have to give up some of his class time to teach new information and new content that he's excited about and spend some of the time reviewing the information that was taught to students previously. That takes long-term vision for the elementary teachers. But think about the impact upon the dialectic stage teacher or the rhetoric teacher who's now teaching students who have the basics of U.S. history committed to memory. That will change things completely as you discuss these ideas with your students. You're going to be able to go into those questions about how do we know this is true much quicker. You'll be able to analyze the material much faster because the students are already familiar with the content. They don't have to learn it for the first time. Earlier, I mentioned that elementary teachers needed to focus on both content and method. We thought about content, but what of method? And I think method, as I listen, I was in the book room yesterday, and I was sitting back at a table, and one of the book tables was playing a song, and they were playing a choral recitation that it sounded like some school had written, and it was some historical information that was put to music. And we've gained, since I've started coming to ACCS conferences, there's been a lot of progress made in understanding how effective that method of choral recitations or chanting is in committing some of this idea to memory. We saw this with the Shirley Grammar program. It was a great example of how you could do this. And we were amazed that we watched young children commit all this to memory through the songs that they sing together. We've seen it used in Latin class to teach different endings. I've seen it used to teach the names of all 50 states and some particular facts associated with each state. We know that committing words to music is one of the very best ways to memorize something. Sometimes this works a whole lot better than we wish it would. You know, you turn on that oldies radio station, songs that you haven't heard for 20 years, and you're just amazed at how well you remember all those lyrics, some of which you wish you could hit the delete key from your mind and get those out of your head. Or sometimes you get that annoying song stuck in your head all day and you just want to turn it off, but you can't. And this is true with commercial ads and jingles. And you'll notice that I'm trying not to give you any specific examples here because I don't want you to blame me for sticking something in your head. So try not to think too hard about that example of what I'm talking about. Maybe sorry. So my suggestion to put U.S. history facts to a jingle? Sure. know, why not? Take a popular melody, as I heard yesterday, and put some historical facts to that memory or to that melody, and have your kids teach it and tell the fifth grade teacher about the song that you wrote in the fourth grade so they can enjoy singing your creation too. This is an effective way to teach the grammar of history. And in the seven laws, besides choral recitations and chants, Gregory also encourages us not to neglect the use of paper and pen in memory work. There's a place for handwork in committing things to memory. So a regular classroom teacher will find the best methods to teach the content of the history being studied, the best methods measured by keeping student interest in the lesson. A classical teacher will ask himself, what is the basic grammar of that historical period that the student should know, and will focus not only on the current year, but will focus on later years with the idea of sowing seeds for a later harvest. The teacher will review and repeat the information so the students have this information memorized. And they'll review information that was taught previous years so that information isn't lost. That's what a classical teacher should do in the grammar stage of the trivium. This type of teaching is old-fashioned. That's what we want. We don't want new-fashioned. We want old-fashioned. The way that we currently teach, if we don't teach classically, is really new, a new-fashioned teaching. Old-fashioned, I want us to think about how our teaching style fits into the history of education. Classical education, classical teaching, is the type that was done historically both in the United States and in Europe. We want to teach classically. We want the old-fashioned way. We want the time-tested way. We want to use the things that have proven themselves over time, and we know that they work. We don't want to experiment with kids. Okay? They're too precious. What about the dialectic stage teacher? What about the teacher who's teaching in that PERT stage? At Logos, we've defined this as halfway through the 7th grade year, 8th and 9th grades. During this stage, the students are introduced to formal logic. That's the key course in their study for the dialectic stage. The purpose of teaching them logic is to equip them with the ability to make sound arguments. We also want them to have an ability to make strong arguments. We want them to know what a valid argument is. We want them to know what a true argument is. We want them to be able to make well-reasoned arguments, and we want them to be able to identify when arguments haven't been constructed well. We want them to recognize fallacious reasoning. We want some bell to go off in their head as they're listening to someone and say, you know, that doesn't sound quite right. And we want them to have the skill to figure out whether it's right or not and why it's wrong. Okay, where did the reasoning break down? These are the skills that we teach in our formal logic classes. But remember that the ultimate purpose of classical education is to equip students with the tools of learning. Students in the PERT stage naturally like to argue, and they're more interested in the meaning of things. They want to know what's true, but they want to know. They take logic for the entire year, introductory logic during the first semester, intermediate logic during the second semester, an hour a day, 5 days a week. Okay, if that's the only logic training that they have, eventually what will happen over time as they move into high school? They will remember that not all arguments are created equal, but the skills that they are taught in the logic class will fall into disuse, and they'll forget much of what they've been taught. If this were true in teaching the grammar of history, would it not also be true in teaching the skills and tools of logic? That's one thing to consider, that all teachers can learn the grammar of the various subjects taught in the elementary grades. I mean, with a little study, we can all learn specific times, dates, and places. But what about all the teachers in the PERT and the poetic stage studying formal logic? Can and should all PERT stage teachers know logic? And I think the answer is yes. And I think I've been somewhat reluctant to conclude that. I've always known that it was been best. But it's kind of daunting. How am I going to find time to learn formal logic? But that's what we need to do. That's exactly what we need to do to be teaching classically. At Logos this year, we had the most staff training we've ever had with the secondary teachers. We took 20 weeks, weekly staff meetings, to study formal logic. And even at this pace, we really hurried through the material. We met once a week from 7 a.m. to 7:45 a.m., and we covered 14 different types of tools related to formal logic. And I think we've gotten through about half of the work that we need to do to really make a significant change in the ways that we are teaching our courses. At the end of the staff training, we've gone through, and Jim had introduced us to all of these tools of logic. We certainly didn't have a complete understanding of the tools. We'd had one lesson on most of them. So at our last meeting of the year, we started to review, and we made a list of five. We hoped to get through in an hour. We ended up getting through two. And we picked the first two logic tools that we had studied, and this was really more of a workshop than anything else. The other meetings were really classroom sessions where Jim was a teacher and the staff was the students. At the final meeting, we took one of the first tools, defining words by genus and difference. Jim reviewed what the tool was, clarifying exactly what it was, and then all of the teachers had brought in some of the materials from one of the classes that they taught, that they teach during the year, and all the teachers were given time then to write some definitions by genus and difference using those skills. And after we all had time to write some, we went around the room, we shared them with one another. Oh, that's a good one. Here's how you could make that one better. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Now I can write this one in my class. And we helped one another. After we finished working on genus and difference definitions, then we took the next tool of logic and we talked about discussion and debate. And we did the same thing. We reviewed the principles for discussion and debate. And then just as we did before, we each thought about our class and our course objectives and what are some possible debate topics that we could use in the following year. We wrote those down in enough detail so that we could remember them next year. We're getting older and our memories are getting weaker, and we wanted to plan and make sure these things happened. And we did the same thing. We shared with each other the resolutions that we'd written, the debate topics that we'd come up with, and we worked with one another on how to refine them. Okay, stating things positively instead of negatively, things like that. And we finished after about an hour and a half, and rather than getting through four or five, we'd gotten through two of the tools in review. But next year, Lord willing, that's exactly what I hope to do with the rest of the tools on the list, is go back through, have Jim review them, and have us all work through how can I apply these things in my class. And we talked about, like I said, 14 things, other things like hypothetical syllogisms and identifying formal fallacies, truth values of statements, things like that relating to formal logic. If we don't do that, I'm convinced, by my own experience in teaching and by working with teachers, what will happen is all that we studied this year in our staff training will be lost. Lost in the sense that it won't make any difference in the way that we teach our classes. Committing things to memory requires the same work, and really it requires even more work for adult learners than it does for children. We tried, as a way to practice a couple years ago, using memory. All of the secondary teachers were asked to memorize something. They could do a passage of scripture or they could do a poem, and then we shared it with one another. And it was hard to memorize things, harder for some than others. Some it was easier, but it was good. It was a good experience. If we don't work through the application of these tools, we'll naturally drift back into teaching the new-fashioned way. We'll naturally drift back into selecting important content. We'll pick methods that are good for creating student interest. We'll probably be teaching in a Christian perspective, but I don't think we'll be teaching in a classical perspective the way that I want us to, and I think the way that we should. If we're going to make a change in the way that we teach, it'll take reprogramming. We have to keep in mind that our goal is not only to teach the content, but to use the information to teach our students the tools of learning. The subjects supply material, but as Dorothy Sayers says, they are all to be regarded as mere grist for the mental mill to work on. That's what I want us to do. Let me give you a couple specific examples of what we did. One of the basic skills that a logic student learns is the necessity and importance of defining terms carefully. When two people using the same term have different meanings, they will have difficulty communicating with one another. I have an 8-year-old son whose name is Jackson. He's playing Little League Baseball this summer for the first time. And he's in a league where the kids are 8, 9, and 10, and he's 8. So he's younger and he's shorter than most of the other boys playing on his team. And because he's short, he has a really small strike zone. Jackson's figured out that if he just takes every pitch, watches him cross the plate. Because his strike zone is so small, if he doesn't swing, he'll draw a lot of walks. Okay? His batting average is really low because it's all walks and strikeouts, but his on-base percentage is pretty good. So the other night at dinner, he's getting ready for his last game, and I was trying to encourage him to swing at least one pitch when it was his turn to bat. I told him I wanted him to swing at the ball. And he looked at me with a really confused expression on his face because he knows the difference between balls and strikes. He couldn't understand why I was telling him to swing at a bad pitch. Dad, why do you want me to swing at a ball? I'm supposed to swing at strikes. Of course, I wasn't telling him to swing at a pitch out of the strike zone, just to swing at the ball when it crossed the plate. But he was thinking of the word ball with one definition, and I was thinking of the word ball with another definition. And that's why it's so important to define our terms carefully. Sometimes when people are disagreeing during a discussion, it's because they aren't using the word the same way. Therefore, one of the first things that we teach our logic students is how to correctly and precisely define words. Students in the rhetoric stage will also find this skill extremely important. If I'm standing up and I want to persuade my audience to take a certain position, it may behoove me to define my proposition and the words that make up that proposition carefully. Say, this is what I mean, and I'm going to limit my discussion to this by my definition. I mentioned defining words by genus and difference. A genus is a general category that a word belongs to. The difference is the characteristic or quality that makes the word different from every other species under the genus. For example, a triangle is a three-sided polygon. I have to define the word abolitionist in my class. An abolitionist is a person. That's the genus. But what makes that person different from another person, say a free soiler? An abolitionist is a person who wanted to end slavery immediately, through any means necessary, in every part of the country. A free soiler is a person who wanted to end slavery eventually, not immediately, by lawful means, not by any means, and the free soiler wanted to work through preventing the spread of slavery in the territories. The goal was similar for each. Both wanted to see an end to slavery. The timing was different, and so was the means. I could use genus and difference to define abolitionist and free soiler. Federalism is another term I have to define in my class. Federal system is a type of government that divides authority between two or more locations. The genus in this case is government. The difference is that not all power is located in one location, power and authority, but the power and authority is divided between two or more. Those are a couple of examples. Now imagine this 8th grade student. He goes to logic class and the teacher teaches defining things by genus and difference. What would happen to that student if in the course of their day, they go into the history class, and that teacher is defining words by genus and difference, and the math teacher is defining words by genus and difference, and so is the science teacher, and so is the English teacher? What do you suppose might happen when that student's sitting in Rhetoric 1, and he needs to know how to define a word? He knows he doesn't just have to go to the dictionary. He knows he can write his own definition for the word. He can't just make up the meaning. But he can choose among the definitions, and he will know that one of the tools in his toolbox is to define that word by genus and difference, because he's been taught this in logic, and he's seen it applied in all the other subjects in the curriculum. That's what we want to do to teach classically. We want to figure out, what are the tools that are being taught in the logic class? How can I use the other subjects as grist for the mill and let the students practice using that tool with the other course content? We also talked about debate. Debate is so important because it allows students, again, to apply what they have learned in their study of logic. It forces students to focus on the meaning of individual words. But it also allows them to focus on constructing arguments, and it gives them practice in attacking the arguments made by those debating against them. Now, it's true that sometimes when you start having debates with classes, like in real life, the people will talk past one another and never engage upon the same topic or upon the same questions. But that's one of the things that they learn by having debates and having practice debates. One of the advantages, unlike, not that students feel negatively about genus and difference definitions, but they don't have the same excitement that they do if you stand up in front of a class and say, tomorrow we're going to have a debate. When you tell the class that they're going to have a debate, most of the students are pretty excited by the prospect. They enjoy that kind of learning. We talked about in our staff training, how do you organize a formal debate? one of the advantages of doing that with the entire staff, we didn't invent this, but we came up with a fairly standard structure for a formal debate. And we know now that if I stand up in my class and tell the kids we're going to have a formal debate, they're used to a certain set standard or construction for the debate, and they all know what that is already. They know who's going to speak first and how long that person will have. They know what all the parts are. They just need to know what the resolution is that'll be debated, which side of the debate they'll be assigned to, and when the debate will take place. And they'll probably ask if they have any class time to prepare for it or not. Okay? Typically, the debates are divided into three parts: constructive speeches and rebuttal speeches and the closing arguments. And it's nothing unique to Logos. It's just it's a pretty standard debate format. And the kids know what the roles are, when they're supposed to define the key terms, when they're supposed to rebut, when they're supposed to summarize their arguments, that in the rebuttal the speakers can't introduce new lines of arguments. They know some of those things because they've been taught them in their logic class. And the other secondary teachers know when that's happening in the logic class, so when we can assume that they know how to run a formal debate. And we also talked about how to keep a flow chart of discussion during the debate. Jim uses three columns, and in the first columns, he always records the assertions that are made during the debate, and in the second column, he lists the methods of proof that are offered in support of the assertion, and he makes general comments in the last column. So we also talked about a similar way of knowing how to evaluate and grade the debate. A classical history teacher should schedule class debates. You can identify possible debate topics. Writing the resolutions takes a little bit of work, remembering that the side arguing the affirmative is responsible to prove the resolution beyond a reasonable doubt. The affirmative side has a greater burden of proof. So some of the topics that I could use are: the state is the proper body to judge whether a congressional law is constitutional or not. Or you could turn that around and say the federal government is the proper body to judge. We could debate slavery was the central cause of the war. It was constitutional for South Carolina to nullify the tariff in 1831. Northerners were justified in disobeying the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. If you stop to think about it, you probably come up with more topics than you have time to actually use in your class. The point is, if we're going to teach history classically, we need to schedule some formal debates in our class. Okay, so what I've done for genus and difference, or what I've done for formal debate, is what I think we need to do for all the logic tools to teach classically. So now we're not only thinking about our course objectives and what are most important, but are there any topics that I can use that'll make it easier for me to teach the tools of learning for that stage? It adds a different factor into our equation of choosing what to teach. Okay. All right, now what about the next level? What about at the rhetoric level? We think students move from the pert to the poetic stage at about the 10th grade. In the same way that we use course material for the grist for the mill in the grammar stage and in the dialectic stage, we want to do the same thing in the rhetoric stage. The tools of learning for rhetoric are easier to identify than the tools of learning for logic. There aren't as many. There are five canons of rhetoric, and they're more easily understood. The trick in rhetoric is not to figure out what to do. It's to be able to do it well. That just takes practice. The five canons of rhetoric are memory, style, delivery, arrangement, and invention. Well, one way that you could have the students practice using rhetorical tools is to have the students write a report and make an oral presentation on some aspect of the historical period that you are studying. You assign a persuasive paper on why the Battle of Blank was the most important battle of the war, or the most significant cause of the war between the states was blank. Okay. The kids can apply all of those canons of rhetoric to that kind of assignment. One of them is invention. They go through the process of identifying all the arguments and selecting the best or strongest arguments to make the case. Rhetoricians have very formal ways of not just sitting and thinking, now what are the arguments that I can come up with, but a list of questions that anyone can ask themselves about a topic, very systematically finding the best arguments to use to support their position. When they sort out their arguments, they go through their list and they say this one's stronger than that one, and they're picking out the best ones. They're dealing with the canon of invention. Invention has more to do with finding and identifying the best arguments than it does with making things up. We want to apply style. When students write their papers, we should be concerned about the quality of their writing in history class. Style should be just as important as a principle of good writing in history as it is in the literature class. We have a ways to go to make that happen at Logos, to work toward grading writing assignments similarly. That's still on our to-do list. But, you know, we shouldn't just teach students that writing style matters for the English teacher, but the history teacher will take something less. Particularly, one part of style is using ornament. For example, using metaphors and allusions. When I sit and I judge the senior thesis presentations, I notice the rhetoric teacher has done a great job of making sure that the kids use ornament in their speeches. They have to use some allusions. They have to use some metaphors. They have to identify the type of ornament that they're using. But because we haven't given the kids enough practice, their efforts sometimes are kind of wooden. They'll go along and they'll say something in their speech and they're trying to use ornamental language and they'll smile and the class will smile because it just didn't flow very well. Just because they know what it is, but they haven't had enough practice using it. And some kids are more skilled than others. We could help them become proficient in their writing if we required that they do that in other classes. The students should also be required to have a logical arrangement to their paper. Rhetoric students learn some traditional and standard forms of arrangement. Each part of the paper has a specific purpose. When we listen to their speeches, we're listening and we're evaluating for, did they list their main arguments at the beginning of their speech? Did they clearly define their thesis? Did they clearly define the words that they were going to use in their thesis? In their conclusion, did they review all their main arguments? Did they try to cast their opponents in a negative light? Those principles of arrangement can be applied to a history paper. We don't just need to limit ourselves to the three-point paper. We should relate that to what they learn in logic. And they learn arrangement in logic. We should apply arrangement in history. We should require good standards for delivery. We require our students, when they use a manuscript, make at least 60% eye contact with the audience. We should do the same thing in history that we do in rhetoric. The writing and delivery of a historical paper is one way that we could have the students apply the rhetorical tools to the study of history. But there are other things that we could do. It takes a lot of class time to have them write a paper and give it in class. Another option is to choose materials as an example and conduct an analysis of a rhetorical tool. For example, one of the most significant speeches of the time period that I teach is President Lincoln's second inaugural address. In that speech, Lincoln is thinking out loud about why God has allowed this war, the Civil War, to be brought upon this nation. And he's conjecturing that the nation is paying for the history of slavery. That's his thought. We could take the speech and conduct a rhetorical analysis of it. What arguments did he make? How did he arrange his arguments? What ornament did he include? Are there any metaphors or other types of ornament? Were there any witnesses who described how he delivered the speech? Any newspaper editorials that commented on Lincoln's delivery? The lesson would serve two purposes. The students would learn some of the significant content of the course, and it would give them opportunity to practice using rhetorical tools also. Classical teaching versus regular teaching. I'm a first-year teacher in this thought experiment. How do I go about selecting particular objectives? What questions do I need to ask myself? If I'm a first-year teacher, I'll probably follow the outline of the textbook that's been adopted for use. The textbook author has already made some decisions for me, and I'm going to adopt those in my first year of teaching. He's decided or she's decided what's the most important material about the course. He's sifted through all the information. And we're also accepting his conclusions about these topics. He's also made some decisions about the arrangement of the material. In history, usually it's chronological. In other courses, there might be more options. He's decided which material should be presented first. As we gain experience and knowledge about our subject matter, we'll figure two things out. We'll begin to make some conclusions about how well the author did in selecting the most important material for the subject. Do we agree with him or not? Or do we think he left some things out? Do we think he overemphasized some things that aren't so important? We'll find places, because we read outside of that author, where we'll compare and contrast, and we'll see better the strengths and weaknesses of the text. We may also determine that a different arrangement of the material is important, so we might begin to teach chapters in a different order. Again, less likely to happen in a history class than in another subject. Or we might begin to use supplemental materials and use the textbook less and use more primary source documents in teaching a history course. We may become more comfortable in our knowledge of the chronology of the subject and in knowing what the most important issues are. As we begin to make this transformation, now we need to really apply our understanding of classical philosophy. We want some material and some lessons that teach history from a Christian perspective. We must teach our students about the sovereignty of God. Proverbs said, "The horse is made ready for battle, but victory rests with the Lord." So as a Christian, and we want our kids to think about the Christian history, or how to think like how to think about history like a Christian, we want them to think about God's sovereignty. We also want to apply Christian principles to individuals and to people and to decisions. Was this decision just? Was this man righteous? Was Sherman's march to the sea a just act? Was slavery biblical? Was Abraham Lincoln right to go to war against the seceding states? We want to ask these questions and have the kids apply their understanding of the Bible to them. But applying a Christian philosophy of education doesn't get us to the classical part. To get to the classical part, we have to select lessons that will allow the students to practice using the tools of learning for the grammar stage, for the logic stage, for the dialectic stage. I could see a teacher assigning a report and having two completely different reasons for it. One, not thinking about classical philosophy, we might assign a report because that's what history teachers do. And there's value in reports. It's that handwork, and we want the kids to remember something and learn something in detail. But we might not. We could assign a report and not have in mind practicing rhetorical tools. But that's what we want to do. We want to think about style and invention and arrangement when we have them write a report. And that would be our purpose in assigning the report. So the way that we evaluate that report would have to match up with that purpose. I have to keep in mind the core content if I'm going to teach classically. I have to determine what the essential elements are. I have to figure out the core arguments. I have to teach my kids how to analyze those core arguments. I want to use certain methods in my class. If I'm an elementary teacher, I want to use methods that are going to enhance memory. If I'm a dialectic teacher, I want to use methods that allow them to practice constructing arguments and analyzing arguments. And if I'm a rhetoric stage teacher, I want methods that allow them to take what they have to say and say it persuasively, say it elegantly. Okay. And I can find examples, historical examples, besides things that the kids have created, and we can analyze arguments. We can look at President Jackson and John C. Calhoun, and we can break their arguments down and apply logical analysis to those. Choosing course objectives in a classical school should vary from a Christian school. We might change objectives to give us objectives that are easier to use in applying the tools of learning. You might teach something because it just facilitates the tools of learning that you might not if you weren't thinking that way. But the ultimate goal of all of our choices at every stage is to provide students with the tools of learning, for that is the goal of classical education. Thank you.